The topic which I was going to talk about is pretty broad. It's about democracy and markets and the way the world order is evolving. There is a kind of a standard version on this, which I won't waste much time on. You've heard it and seen it often. The standard version is that there's a sharp break taking place in the nature of world order. There's a new era opening, which is an era of great promise for the growth of markets and growth of democracy. The United States has won a major victory. The Cold War, say, 1989 definitive end, symbolizes the break and the new opening. There are other processes. The process of globalization has changed the nature of the world radically, and there's minimization of the state and an increase in market relations and so on. That's the general picture. It's even even formalized as the Clinton Doctrine. The National Security Advisor a couple of years ago, Anthony Lake, who's sort of the intellectual of the administration, presented the Clinton Doctrine as expressing these views. His basic thesis was that until the end of the Cold War, the United States had been engaged in containing the threat to market democracy, but now that threat is suppressed, and we can now go on to enlarge the reach of market democracy as we'd been intending to do all along and are now free to do. I think there's a good deal of reason for skepticism about every aspect of this picture, every aspect. Some of the aspects of the picture are just flat wrong by everyone's agreement. Others are at least debatable. So take, say, minimization of the state. One of the main features of contemporary doctrine is that the day of the large active state is over, and that we have to minimize the state and move to more market principles. You can get an estimate as to the accuracy of that in the latest annual volume of the World Bank Development Report. They every year come out with their flagship publication. A lot of fanfare and so on, supposed to represent mainstream economic thinking. Kind of interesting because it rapidly oscillates from one year to the next, which may tell you something. This year is about the state and markets, and they give some data on the ratio of state expenditures to GNP worldwide, and it shows what people should have known. It's differentiated. There are some areas of the world where, in fact, the state is being minimized, that is, reducing relative to GNP, namely those areas that have been under the influence and control of the international financial institutions in the United States, sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. In those areas, in fact, state expenditures relative to GNP are low and declining, and they're also all economic disasters. In the rich countries, OECD countries, that's the place where the ratio of state expenditures to GNP is the highest, and it's been going up. It went up quite sharply in the 1980s. It's still going up, though less sharply. In the Asian growth area, which has been essentially out of World Bank U.S. domination, state expenditures relative to GNP have been going up. They're not as high as the rich countries, but going up. So what you do have, there is a picture. Namely, the place where the international institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, U.S. government, in the areas where they can pretty much control policy, the state is indeed declining. It was always lower. It's getting still lower. And in fact, there's a poverty is increasing in absolute terms as well as relative terms. And in general, there's an economic disaster except for a small sector of the population. In the rich countries, exactly the opposite's happening. One might want to draw some conclusions from that. The World Bank doesn't. But anyway, those are the data about minimization of the state. What about markets? Is this a period of growth of markets? Well, no, and in fact, it's known not to be. So if you look at the technical literature by international economists and so on, they point out I'll quote one of the major scholarly studies of this by an economist of the GATT Secretariat, that the last 25 years have been a period of sustained assault on free markets, led by the rich countries, the OECD countries, with the United States far in the lead. Reaganite anti-market measures, he estimates at about three times the level of those of other OECD countries, and they're very severe. This, incidentally, is quite well known. You read, say, the Foreign Affairs a review of every year. They have a review, the review of the decade in 1990, reviewed the last decade by their editor. You know, this is the major establishment journal. Pointed out that the Reaganites, quote them, that the Reaganites had led the greatest swing toward protectionism since the 1930s. They had shifted the United States from being a supporter of multilateral free trade to being its leading challenger, and the facts do bear that out. The Reagan administration, in fact, essentially doubled protection for U.S. markets by one or another device. They were more protectionist than all post-war administrations combined, and in fact, they boasted about this to the business community. They didn't keep it secret. That's only one part of their radical market interference. They also poured state subsidies into high technology industry under the usual military cover, and in many other ways made sure that at least wealthy sectors in the United States weren't going to have to face market discipline. And that was part of a sustained assault against markets all over, from the rich countries all over the world. On the other hand, it is differentiated. The poorer countries, particularly those that were under the influence and domination of the international financial institutions in the United States, the ones subject to what's called the Washington Consensus, which tells you where it's coming from, they did indeed open themselves up to markets. With consequences that you can observe. Mexico was the most recent example. Case after case is a disaster for most of the population, but it's true that markets have been increasing there. There is also further differentiation. The last 25 years have been a period of restrictive measures on trade, but great liberalization of finance. That's a radical change. That really is a change. And a significant change in world order, but it didn't have anything to do with the Cold War. It took place starting 60s, but radically in the early 1970s. And that led to huge changes. So for the first time in modern history, financial flows have, first of all, been astronomical and very rapid, and also essentially uncorrelated to the real economy. So before this period, say 1970, about 90% of the capital interactions in foreign exchange were related to trade and investment, that is, the real economy. About 10% were speculative. By now, it's about 5% related to the real economy and about 95% speculative. The speculative flows are extremely rapid. About 80% of them have a turnaround time of a week. And most of that is a day, some of it is even minutes, and it's astronomical. It's just shot out of sight. By now it's over $1 trillion a day, totally, you know, outweighing the resources of even rich countries, even the European Union and so on. So that's a big change. And that liberalization of capital has increased, but restriction on trade has increased along with it. That correlation is well known. It's not a perfect correlation, but it's a relationship. In fact, the whole post-war economic system was built on that relationship. When the United States and Britain designed the post-war economic system back, you know, 1945, what's called the Bretton Woods system, it was designed to liberalize trade and restrict finance. So the system that was designed by Harry Dexter White and John Maynard Keynes and the rest of them was designed specifically to try to increase trade. They thought that'd be a good thing, And in order to do that, to restrict capital. So their countries had capital controls. In fact, the OECD countries, the rich ones, maintained capital controls into the 1980s. There are countries that didn't, like Latin America. They're very free and open to international capital, and sub-Saharan Africa. So they have plenty of capital. They don't have capital controls. You can see it. The famous debt crisis hit Latin America and did not hit East Asia, primarily for that reason. The capital flowed out of Latin America to New York banks and to London and so on. The rich people sent their money elsewhere, in other words, instead of investing it domestically. And the Latin American debt is not very different from capital flight. In other words, if they kept their money inside, the famous debt would barely be there. And that indeed is what happened in East Asia, which did have capital controls. It was understood by Keynes, White, and other designers of the world order from 1945 that these two things were generally an inverse relationship. As you liberalized capital, you tended to restrict trade, and conversely. And that remains true. Generally speaking, it's been true of the last 25 years. Very radical liberalization of financial capital and the period of restrictiveness of trade. Even the so-called trade agreements are, in fact, not free trade agreements. They have very severe protectionist elements. I'll come back to that if there's time. Anyhow, the first picture about minimization of the state is true in a very differentiated fashion. It's not true for the rich countries. Not true for East Asia. In fact, the opposite is true, but it is true for the poorer countries and increasing for the poorer countries. And that, in fact, is part of the Washington Consensus. That's part of what's imposed on them. Now, actually, it's a little more nuanced than that, because another recent change is that internal to the rich countries, especially the United States and England, there's an analog to that. So the state has not declined relative to GNP in England and the United States under Thatcher and Reagan, but it's shifted. It's shifted to more and more service to the wealthy and less service to the rest of the population, which is the domestic analog to the international system. So yes, there is liberalization for the poor, like, you know, 7-year-old children have to learn responsibility and, you know, get out of that cycle of dependency and face market discipline and so on, but not rich people. They have to be protected from market discipline. They have to be protected by socialization of risk and socialization of cost, along with, of course, privatization of profit and management, but they don't want to face, they have to stay on the cycle of dependency. And that's become very striking in the Reagan and Thatcher years. So after 17 years of Thatcher, state expenditures relative to GNP were exactly what they were when she came in. But the shift in the way the state was functioning was quite substantial. So there was a very sharp increase in poverty, an increase in millions of children in poverty, hunger that hadn't been seen for 50, 60 years, childhood diseases that had been declining and essentially overcome are now back. And it's a kind of a Dickensian picture. At the same time, state expenditures are being used to, in fact, illegally, they keep having scandals to, subsidize aerospace exports and so on and so forth. That's a shift. Same here. I mean, we're all familiar with it, so I don't have to talk about it. But there's been a very sharp shift internally in the United States. In fact, you see it quite strikingly by looking at, everyone knows that, should know at least, that the United States has by far the highest level of inequality of any industrial society. And in fact, it's been, after having declined from about 1945 till around 1970, it's been increasing, and it's now back to what it was around the 1920s, and still going up. But that picture is not, it's true, but it's, again, good to disaggregate it, break it up into its components. Participation in the economy, what's called the market economy, but that's misleading, but participation in the economy leads to a certain distribution of income. Okay, so you know, you have a job and spend money and so on. That leads to a certain distribution of income. Then comes a second factor, a social policy, which is taxes and transfers. Okay, so it's called government action, but in fact it's social policy. And the more democratic the society, the more people participate. If you compare the United States with other industrial societies in market outcomes, what's the inequality there? Well, it's about the same as other societies. So we're, the United States ranks along with the other industrial societies in terms of distribution of income from market outcomes. If you add the effect of social policy, the United States diverges radically. That's where the divergence comes in. So you take into account taxes and transfers, you find the inequality growing very sharply because that's the nature of social policy in the United States, increasingly in England, and that's the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. It's carried, it's not totally there, but they sort of symbolize it. Those are decisions. You know, they're not laws of nature, as you can see from the fact that they don't happen in other similar societies. But this is real, and it's in fact a domestic variant of the international picture that I just briefly sketched. There couldn't be a better symbol of this than Newt Gingrich, who's the leading, you know, no one is more passionate about the need to break the cycle of dependency and learn responsibility and all this sort of thing, but not the people in the district that he represents. Cook County, Georgia, a very rich suburb of Atlanta, he manages to maintain the record for bringing federal subsidies to his district. He's maintained it for some years because there, the rich folk in Cook County, they have to be saved from market discipline. They have to maintain the cycle of dependency. Just as the last budget went through, he managed to sneak in another $500 million for his favorite local charity, Lockheed Martin, which has corporate headquarters down there, and that's standard. I mean, this is like, you know, sort of symbolizes it, but the picture is quite general, and it's a picture you see all around you. You walk a couple of blocks towards Roxbury, you'll see it. Walk a couple of blocks towards, you know, the financial centers, you'll see the other side of it. And that's happening on a global scale as well. So again, in Latin America, there has been which has been subjected to the Washington Consensus and is quite open to international capital flows and so on. There's an absolute increase in poverty, with only two exceptions, Colombia and Chile. Colombia, it's largely because of the drug-based economy is a considerable part of that, and also because it maintains capital controls. In Chile, it's because, contrary to what you read, they have not accepted the Washington Consensus. So it's not a free market society. They, for example, do impose controls on short-term speculative capital flows, and in fact, their major export, copper, most of it comes from a nationalized company, you know, which is quite efficient and so on. So they've managed some sort of nuanced form of development, whatever you want to call it, and though they're not tigers in the Asian sense, they're not disasters in the Mexican sense. That picture seems fairly general, and it's enough to make one think, at least, about the sort of mantra, you know, that we're entering into a new period of markets and minimization of state and so on and so forth. I think if you look closely, it's not that. What about democracy? Is it a new era of democracy? The result of the victory of the United States in the Cold War. Well, you can look at that too. For one thing, notice that to the extent that there is an extension of market principles, there's a decline in democracy. Those two things go hand in hand. When you minimize the state, you don't eliminate decision making. You just transfer it. So it's not being made in the state system, it's being made somewhere else. And where it's the story is this is a transfer of power to the people, but that's not even a joke, so we don't have to waste any time on that. It's a transfer of power to the private sector, undoubtedly, but that's not the people. That's the highly concentrated power system within the private sector. So in fact, it's a transfer of power from the state system, where there's whatever degree of participation there may be, you know, a lot in some countries, less in other countries, but some degree of participation, and in principle, a lot of participation, in fact, full participation in principle. There's a transfer from that system to a system of unaccountable private power, where in principle there is no participation. So you and I, in principle, have nothing to say about the decisions of General Electric and Microsoft. You know, that's a matter of law and principle. Unless you happen to own some stock, then you have as much say as the stock you own, which means if you're in the top few percentage of the population, you own most of the stock and you have most of the say. But there isn't even in principle, and these are unaccountable also. You also can't find out what they're doing. Like you can't read out the books of General Electric. That's a secret. So these are unaccountable private power. Internally, they're essentially totalitarian. If you take a look at the structure of a corporation, it's about as close to the totalitarian model as anything human beings have devised, you know, with power vested at the top, orders going down stage by stage. If you're a middle-level manager, say, you take your orders from above and you hand them down below, as in totalitarian systems, say, Stalinist Russia, there's some interaction, you know, like nothing's totally rigid, and other influences, but it's, as I say, about as close to the totalitarian ideal as humans have constructed, and unaccountable, and that's where decisions are transferred. So to the extent that these processes are taking place, yeah, it's an attack on democracy, virtually by definition, and the efforts to move things in that direction are an attempt to increase that. But even beyond that, let's just take a look at democracy within the state sector, so formal democracy like voting rights and that kind of thing. Here it's a mixed story. So take the regions where the U.S. has been influential. That's primarily the Western Hemisphere. That's the place to look to check the theory that there's been a victory for democracy. We've been trying to contain threats to it. Now we enlarge its scope. So we can look at the Western Hemisphere. Well, that's been studied rather well. There's good scholarship on it. The best scholarly work on the topic is most extensive, is by Thomas Carruthers, is a Latin American specialist who has the advantage of also writing from an insider's perspective, because he was in the Reagan administration in the State Department working on democracy enhancement programs. That was the period of the great victory of democracy in Latin America. He was working on it in the middle, and he's now writing about it as a scholar. And his review, I think, is basically accurate. He points out that there indeed was an increase in democracy, formal democracy in Latin America, and it was in inverse correlation to U.S. influence. That is, the greater the U.S. influence, the less the increase in democracy. So there was an increase in democracy in the Southern Cone, you know, South America, like Argentina, Brazil, Chile. Now, the Reagan administration opposed it, but once it proved irresistible, they sort of went along with it and, in fact, even took credit for it. So in the regions of the least influence, there was an extension of democracy. In the regions of the most influence, which is nearby, you know, the traditional area of U.S. domination, the Caribbean, Central America, that's where there was least increase in democracy. There were formal democracies, but as Carruthers puts it, I'll quote him, the United States would only tolerate top-down forms of democracy, of democratic change, that maintained the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied and maintained the basic order of quite an undemocratic societies. Yeah, that's correct. If you look closely at the region, you'll find out that that's what happened. So yes, there was a kind of a victory of democracy, and which was substantial in the regions of less U.S. influence, was less in the regions of more U.S. influence, and in fact maintained the structures of the undemocratic societies in the same power systems, crucially. That was a crucial part of the move toward democracy. I think you find, again, an internal analog to that. Come back to it if there's time. The model that was given when Anthony Lake announced the Reagan, the Clinton Doctrine, you know, the Great New Doctrine, he gave an example, a prize example, to illustrate how it's going to work, the new victories of markets and democracies. The example he gave was Haiti. And it's a good example because the recent developments there are post-Cold War, so one can't give any arguments about this was a reflection of the Cold War or whatever. Actually, I don't think those arguments work very well for earlier periods either, but here the question is moot because the events in question are after the end of the Cold War. And Haiti was offered as the example of the our achievements and the promise of bringing democracy and markets to a benighted world. So that's a good one to look at. And then when you look at it, you find it illustrates all the phenomena I've just been describing quite accurately, I think. When there was a democratic election, first democratic election in Haiti in 1990. The United States did not oppose it. The United States had its own candidate, Marc Bazin, a World Bank official. And it took for granted, everyone took for granted, he was going to win. He had all the resources, he had all the rich people working for him, and so on. So everyone figured he'd be a shoo-in. So that looked like an okay election, maintained the top-down structure of power. Well, to everyone's surprise, he didn't win. In fact, he got smashed. He got 14% of the vote, and two-thirds of the vote went to a candidate nobody thought about, namely Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was supported by a something that no one had noticed, namely a huge popular grassroots movement in the peasant society and the urban slums. Nobody pays any attention to those people, but they had been developing lively organizations and grassroots movements and so on, and a very vibrant civil society, sufficient so they even swept their own president into office with two-thirds of the vote and no resources. That's pretty remarkable. In fact, that is probably the most dramatic victory of democracy in the Western Hemisphere in quite a long time. In fact, maybe ever, you could argue. Or not just the Western Hemisphere. It was a pretty dramatic event, rarely takes place. And that was an election, real democratic election, post-Cold War. The United States did react. It was extremely hostile. The United States moved at once to undermine the democratic government, cut off aid, except for opponents of the president, supported business elements that were trying to undermine him. This is despite the fact that his policies were quite successful. In fact, mildly reformist policies, so successful that even the World Bank and the IMF were impressed and were giving loans and so on. But the United States was dedicated to undermining it. You could see the dedication rather strikingly by looking at refugee policy, which is quite revealing in this case. During the period of the brutal dictatorship that the U.S. had backed, there was an enormous flow of refugees from Haiti. People were fleeing from terror and poverty. They were turned back by force, illegally. This is in radical violation of the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights, but the Carter administration and the Duvalier dictatorship made an agreement, which was then extended by Reagan, to forcefully return people fleeing from Haiti and not to grant them asylum. And that continued until the democratic election. At that point, the refugee flow stopped, virtually stopped. There's still trickle. And in fact, it reversed because people started going back. The Haitians started returning in this period of hopefulness. U.S. refugee policy also reversed. Towards granting asylum to refugees. In fact, asylum requests were granted at 50 times the rate during the democratic interlude as before, because now they were fleeing a democratic government, not a murderous dictatorship, so therefore they were real political refugees. A couple of months later, just to dramatize the fact, a few months later there was a military coup. President Aristide was overthrown. U.S. refugee policy reversed. Now people were again fleeing from brutal terror. It was pretty bad. I was there for a little while myself, but you didn't even have to be there to know how bad it was. It was awful. People were fleeing from poverty, terror, torture, and they were forced back. The United States imposed, and again, obviously, illegal blockade to force them back, and that's still going on. A couple hundred were just forced back a few weeks ago. Well, that symbolizes what happened. When the military coup took place, the United States made the right noises. It was the Bush administration about seeing how bad this is and we're in favor of democracy, but they moved at once to support the military coup. The Organization of American States called an embargo. The U.S. instantly undermined it. Within a few weeks, President Bush had exempted U.S. firms from the embargo. So the embargo was fine, but U.S. firms were not going to participate. The U.S. maintained connections with the high military officers, kept training them, kept relationships with them, had them on their, you know, biggest killers on the payroll. We don't know the details of this. The reason we don't know the details is that when U.S. troops were finally sent in, they stole all the documents and are refusing to release them or to give them back to the government of Haiti. There are now still 160,000 pages of documents about terror, torture, relations with the U.S. That the U.S. simply refuses to release. Human Rights Watch, which has seen some of them, says that they're being withheld because they would have embarrassing revelations about U.S. relations with the terror and torture. Since they're not available, I can't guess, so you make your own guess. But the connections are clear, as is the training and so on. Furthermore, the embargo went, undermining the embargo went far beyond exempting U.S. firms. When Clinton came in fact, the embargo was further undermined. So U.S. trade with Haiti went up under Clinton during the period of the terror. But more strikingly, both the Bush and the Clinton administrations secretly authorized the Texaco Oil Corporation to ship oil to the military junta. Now, oil is the centerpiece of any embargo. You know, no society is going to run if it doesn't have energy. And they're running on oil. Everyone in Haiti could see that oil was coming in, you know, like the rich families were building big oil farms and that sort of thing. But theoretically, it wasn't coming in. The CIA was testifying for to Congress that it had been cut off. It was plainly coming in. And the day before the U.S. troops landed, it was revealed, a major story on Associated Press, major leak from the Justice Department, that both the Bush and the Clinton administrations had in fact informed the Texaco Oil Company that shipments of oil would be illegal, but that they wouldn't do anything about it. So in other words, go ahead. So oil went in. In fact, there was no embargo. After the population had been subjected to 3 years of terror and torture in the expectation that the popular civil society would be wiped out, or intimidated at least, U.S. troops did go in to restore democracy. What they restored was the policies of the candidate who had lost the election in 1990. President Aristide was allowed to return, but on condition, explicit condition, that he accept a social and economic program written in Washington, which the core element of which was that the resources of the reconstituted government would have to be directed primarily to civil society, particularly the private sector, both native and foreign. So that, spell that out. The private sector, native, means the rich folk up in the hills who were supporting the military coup. They get the resources, and of course investors in the United States. So investors in New York are Haitian civil society, but not the peasants in the hills or the people in the slums of Port-au-Prince. They're not Haitian civil society. And that's the policy, and that's what's been imposed. If you look at the economic, in fact, that is the program of the U.S. candidate in 1990 who lost. This is being offered, remember, as the great victory for democracy and markets, which I'll come to. These programs are very carefully, in fact, again, it's not particularly a secret, like Strobe Talbot, the State Department representative, when he testified to Congress. Congress was concerned that the U.S. might lose control of Haiti, you know, after troops withdraw and so on. He said, no, we will not lose control. We'll still be able to control Haiti through U.S. aid and the private sector. So don't worry about it. It's under control. Democracy. The economic policies are picking up again from what they were in the 80s. Haiti had been subjected to very strict what are called neoliberal policies, you know, Washington consensus policies in the 1980s, as before, in fact. The U.S. had declared that these policies were going to be, you know, create an economic miracle, that Haiti was going to become the Taiwan of the Caribbean. That's what they predicted, knowing perfectly well that Taiwan had followed a radically different course. They couldn't have failed to know that. But Haiti had all the proper solutions, you know, open up your markets, cut traffic, tariffs, privatize, you know, get rid of the state, all these good things. And they did. And in fact, you know, there was, it was economically successful for civil society in the U.S. sense, that is, the private sector, both native and foreign. On the other hand, wages declined about 50%, malnutrition increased, you know, suffering increased, and so on. That was, and Haiti remained Haiti, not Taiwan. In fact, it became more so. Well, now there's been an interlude. The policies are being picked up again. U.S., there's plenty of aid going in, but very carefully directed. About for the overwhelming majority of the population, their livelihood depends on agriculture and handicrafts. Nothing is going to that. There's no aid for those things. Aid is going to the export sector, the, you know, assembly plants, kind of maquilas, you know, the foreign-owned assembly plants, where they pay ridiculous wages. I mean, indescribably low wages, have horrendous working conditions, mostly women. They get subsidies. As does the agro-export sector, which is mostly plantations and so on, but not the sector in which the people work. They don't get any subsidy. So there's cheap subsidized electricity, say, for agro-export and industry, but not for the population. They don't get it because that would be price control, and we're opposed to that in principle, at least for poor people. Before these reforms began, Haiti was producing virtually all of its rice domestically. It's the main subsistence food. And that has a lot of interaction with the rest of the economy. So rice production means processing and, you know, commerce and all sorts of other stuff. So that was a core part of the economy. By now, after the reforms, the neoliberal reforms, it's down to 50% and declining, with the obvious effects on the rest of the economy. The Haitian rice producers are supposed to open themselves up to foreign competition. That's kind of good for you because, you know, leads to efficiency and the market and all that sort of thing. But there's a little footnote there. They're opening themselves up to competition with highly subsidized U.S. rice producers, whose subsidies, in fact, went up sharply under the Reagan years as part of the radical attack on markets during the Reagan years. To the point where by 1987, U.S. rice producers were getting about 40% of their income just from government subsidies. And Haitian peasants are supposed to compete with them because the market is such a wonderful thing and good for you and so on and so forth. Well, remember, I didn't pick this example. This is the example that's chosen to be the prize example of the victory of markets and democracy. And in fact, it tells you a lot. It tells you a lot about markets. Market discipline is for poor people. Not for rich people. You know, they need the protection of the nanny state and get it. Democracy is okay as long as but it's not assessed by process. It's assessed by outcome. So it comes out the way we want, leaving top-down societies with the power structure intact, then it's okay. But if it comes out the wrong way, like if the wrong people happen to organize and develop their own policies and programs, then no good. Then you have one or another method to get rid of it. Well, I think that's what we really find when we look at the examples that were chosen, and they're revealing. Let's look a little further at democracy. There's a long tradition of American democracy, and it's worth remembering what it was. The United States is the country to look at if you want to understand what modern industrial democracy means. It is, I it's fair to call it the most free country in the world, the most democratic country in the world. It has the most stable, long-standing democratic institutions. They go way back. They've been resilient and so on. So it's about as good a model of the ideal case, if you like, of capitalist industrial democracy, and therefore worth studying quite carefully. I mean, quite apart from the fact that we happen to live in it, so we're interested, and it's by far the most powerful country in the world, so it matters a lot what it's like. And it's an interesting history. You should study about it, in my view, in junior high school, but at least in, you know, graduate school political science courses, but it's not really much study. The place to look at the nature of American democracy, the obvious place to look, is in the Constitutional Convention, the debates on the Constitutional Convention, which laid out the framework of what became American democracy, and they're interesting. They're not much read. What people usually read is the Federalist Papers. I'm sure you've read those. But the Federalist Papers are a misleading source. The Federalist Papers were propaganda, remember. They were written in order to convince the public, who didn't like what was happening much, to convince them to accept the new constitutional system. So when you read the Federalist Papers, you're reading kind of a watered-down version, a prettified version of the thinking that was going on. In the debates on the Constitutional Convention, it's much clearer. And they're interesting. The main framer, as you know, was James Madison, who was at the sort of libertarian end and a very intelligent and lucid analyst and exponent of his views. And his views largely prevailed. I mean, there was very little opposition to them at the end. He was quite clear on what he was doing. The model that everyone had in mind, of course, is England. That was the most democratic existing society of the day, so they were sort of, their mother country. So they're asking, well, you know, what about the British parliamentary system? And there were debates about whether to accept it or modify it or whatever. Madison pointed out that the British system would have problems if they transferred it over here, and that is because the United States, they did want to make it, he and the other founding fathers, as they're called, did want to make it a more participatory and democratic society. But he said a democratic society has a serious flaw. The flaw is that in a democratic society, the people can participate. And he said, suppose this were to take place in England. Suppose, for example, in England, that they really allowed people to vote, which they didn't. He said, well, the first thing people would do would be to call for what we nowadays call agrarian reform. That is, they would call for changes in the land laws, which would grant more people access to the highly privatized and centralized land system. And that, you know, land was a crucial part of the economy then. And he says, well, we obviously can't accept that. You know, we don't want to have any system that will allow people to participate and infringe on the rights of private property and wealth. So therefore, we have to be careful not to allow a democratic system in which things really function democratically. We have to design a system in which power is in the hands of the wealth of the nation, I'm quoting, the more capable set of men, those who are sympathetic with the rights of property. Okay, they must have the power, and the rest must be dispersed and factionalized in such a way that they don't really interfere with the rights of power. Actually, Madison, who was no fool, recognized that this problem was going to become greater as time went on. As he put it, if I can read my own notes, he said there's going to be an increase in the proportion of the population that labors under all the hardships of life and secretly sighs for a more equal distribution of its blessings. Okay, there's going to be an increase in that. And if those people really have an ability to participate, they're going to do things which will infringe on the right of private power and private property and the wealthy, and therefore we have to design the system so that doesn't happen. And indeed, the system was designed so that that wouldn't happen. That was the role of the Senate, was to represent the wealth of the nation, and the role of the separation of powers, and so on and so forth. How well it functioned, you can argue. It's an interesting question, but it's worth noticing that this idea about the nature of democracy has a long, this problem in the nature of democracy, you know, that namely if people can vote, they're going to vote in their own interests, and infringe on the rights of private power and wealth. That insight goes way back, goes back to the origins of political theory. So you read the first major book on political theory in something like our sense, Aristotle's Politics. That's a core question of Aristotle's Politics. Aristotle distinguishes tyranny, oligarchy, and democracy, and has a long, elaborate discussion of each, and favors democracy. He didn't think it was perfect, but he favored democracy as the best system. For him, a democracy was very straightforward. It meant a community of equals, or to be precise, free men who are equals. And that phrase, free men, is rather crucial, but put that aside for a moment. A community of free men who are equal and participatory. Unless it's equal, and they can't be seriously participatory, he noticed the same problem that Madison did. Exactly the same problem. He said, suppose that you did have a democracy where everyone participated, but you had radical inequality, so concentration of wealth. He said, well, then the poorer part of the population, which is the majority, will use their voting power for their own interests, to advance their own interests, instead of the common good of all. Okay, and the goal of a democracy for Aristotle was to advance the common good of all. But if you had inequality, radical inequality, well, yeah, the majority of the population would vote for their own interests, which would not be the common good of all. So therefore, he had to do something about that. It's the same problem that Madison faced, you know, exactly the same problem, but they reached opposite conclusions. Madison's conclusion was that we should reduce democracy so that you don't get the threat from the population. Aristotle's was the opposite. You should reduce inequality. So therefore the problem won't arise, and you could have a real participatory democratic system. So Aristotle called for what we today would call a welfare state. He said that a democracy must be based on use of public revenues to ensure lasting prosperity for everyone. Welfare state, in other words. And then he describes in some detail how you could proceed to do that in Athens. Do it differently here, but the same kinds of questions. And then if everyone had moderate but sufficient income, you wouldn't have this problem that both he and Madison faced. But notice that their choices were radically different. One choice was to aim for equality and participation in democracy. The other, the one on which our country was founded, was to reduce the threat of democracy, maintain the inequality, and ensure that power remains in the Senate, you know, the capable class of men, the wealthy part of the wealthy part of the society. That's now internationalized. So this huge financial capital that's flowing around the world is sometimes called by international economists a virtual Senate, meaning it has the power to ensure, if you really liberalize capital, to ensure that no country will be able to undertake social policies that strike at the interests of the wealthy. Because if any country moves in that direction, the capital quickly flows out of it and the country goes down the tube. So it's a virtual Senate, you know, kind of a generalization of Madison's Senate. And the opposite of the Aristotelian conception of democracy is necessarily based on a welfare state and equality. To go back to that word free men, a democracy for Aristotle meant men, you know, not women, and free, not slaves, you know, or aliens. So it's a subpart of the population, but it's a little hard to dump on Aristotle for that, since given that those questions weren't even addressed, and badly addressed, until this century, you know, and still are far from addressed. But that's a significant qualification. But the principles are there, and they come right up to the present. It's also been understood this battle, sort of struggle up and back between the two conceptions of democracy is a large part of modern history, major theme of modern history, runs right through the 19th century. It's hard to remember now, but in the 19th century, which is a rather anarchic period in the United States, it was quite generally assumed that you not only had to have an equal and participatory society, but that even wage labor was an intolerable infringement on human rights. That wasn't a radical position. That was the slogan of the Republican Party, for example. You could read it in the New York Times editorials in 1870. It was the slogan under which many Northern workers fought the Civil War. It was Abraham Lincoln's, you know, position. Wage labor is not very different from chattel slavery, because it's a fundamental infringement on rights. It was the major theme of the working class press, which was quite lively around this area, run by, you know, women from the farms and artisans and so on. Their position was, look, if you have a democracy, the people who work in the mills have to own them, and you have to move towards real participation and direct control and so on. And that remained major themes of perfectly mainstream U.S. thinking right up until the corporatization of America about 100 years ago, when corporations developed, collectivist legal institutions, as they were called, which got enormous rights, you know, the rights of persons, but in fact well beyond persons, because they're immortal and huge in comparison with persons. That was sharply attacked by conservatives, a breed that doesn't exist anymore, but did exist a century ago, people who really believed in classical liberal doctrines. They recognized that corporations were themselves a major attack on markets, and that also an attack on the natural rights doctrines on which, you know, conceptions of human rights and liberty were developed. That was a big change, and it's again not graven in stone. These were decisions. Well, I haven't really even started in what I wanted to talk about, which is how all this looks in the modern world, and I'll stop. But let me just say that none of this is changing. It's all going on right today. You know? So you take today's headlines, you find all of this stuff happening. So take, say, the debate over fast track, you know, recent debate. What was the fast track debate about? Well, the way it was presented was as if it was a debate over trade. But that can't be right. You know? I mean, it wasn't, the fast track legislation was not about trade. It was about who participates in deciding what kind of trade relations to make. It was about democracy. Fast track means no participation. Right. I mean, you can, it's perfectly consistent to be opposed to fast track and to be in favor of free trade. Right. In fact, it's perfectly consistent. In fact, that's not very different from the actual position of the opponents of fast track, although you wouldn't know that from the newspapers. So the labor movement, which is continually denounced, you know, because of its opposition to trade and, you know, muscle-bound and crude, unenlightened tactics and all this kind of stuff, nationalistic, they actually have a position on trade. You wouldn't know it because it was suppressed, totally suppressed during the NAFTA debate, and is still suppressed. But their position is that international trade is a very good thing. We ought to have it. We ought to have more of it. But it shouldn't solely be based on investor rights. It should be what are called free trade agreements are really investor rights agreements. And the position of labor is, well, there's something beyond investors. There's people, for example. There's working people, there's communities, there's the environment, meaning future generations and so on. Now, they also should have a, trade agreements should be concerned with their rights, not just with investor rights. The reason for the opposition to fast track was, well, that's a way of avoiding all these things and ensuring that it's just going to be investor rights. Because if it's fast track, no participation, just the more capable set of men deciding on their own without anybody bothering them, yeah, sure, it'll be investor rights, like NAFTA, which is not a free trade agreement. NAFTA is highly protectionist in many respects, and it's an investor rights agreement. That was the issue at fast track. You wouldn't know that looking at the discussion, but if you just think through the logic, it's kind of obvious. I mean, fast track in itself has nothing to do with trade. It has to do with decisions. Right? It has to do with democracy. And the question is, should the population have some knowledge of what's going to hit them and some voice in determining it? Or should it be done behind their backs by the more capable set of men, the wealth of the nation, who will do it in their interests? That was the issue over fast track. And strikingly, if you looked at the discussion, you couldn't see that said, although it's not a deep point. I mean, it's like a superficially obvious point. Let's proceed. The crucial issue behind fast track it's a fair speculation, since this is, there's no discussion about this, so you can only speculate, but I think a very fair speculation is that the issue behind Fast Track was not whether Chile should be brought into NAFTA. Nobody cared much about that, including the Chileans. What they did care about was something else, which was unmentioned, and that's the multilateral agreement on investments. Now, that's no joke. There is a big investment treaty going on in secret. Crucially, it better go on in secret, because if people find out about it, they are not going to like it. You know, so it's going on in secret at the OECD, you know, Organization of the Rich Countries, and the World Trade Organization. It's been going on for about 2 years now, being negotiated. At the World Trade Organization, it's going to be blocked, probably. And the reason it's going to be blocked is that the third world countries have a voice, and they're not going to let it go through, it looks. India and Malaysia, particularly, have been blocking it at the World Trade Organization. But at the OECD, there's not going to be anything much that will block it. I mean, there may be reservations here and there, but mostly the rich countries are in favor of it, because what it is a super investor rights agreement. It gives investors rights that you can't imagine. For example, it would give investors, foreign investors or U.S. investors, the right to, say, invest, say, in this neighborhood, without any concern for marketing restrictions, like are they selling hazardous goods, or where they put the factory, is it going to help deprived neighborhoods, are there going to be women participating, you know, anything, just about anything you can think of. Any condition that a community or a country might want to institute to determine how investment takes place, any social, environmental, health, other condition is ruled out. Investors have rights to move assets freely, do what they want, unaccountably, and so on. Furthermore, they're going to be granted legal rights that they don't have now, the right to sue in case they decide that something is an expropriation, that is an infringement on the rights granted under this treaty. On the other hand, so they can sue, corporations can sue governments, national governments, local governments, any level, but nobody can sue corporations. That's a crucial part of this agreement. It's one-sided. The suits don't go to the courts. They go to secret panels, arbitration panels made up by the very same people, you know, bankers, investors, and so on. They make some decision in secret, and that's how they decide whether someone is infringing on the rights of investors, let's say by imposing restrictions on, I don't know, marketing cigarettes to children or whatever comes along next. That's the multilateral agreement on investments. Well, that's working through in secret. Of course, not technically secret, like, you know, you can find out about it if you really work. And there are protest meetings about it and so on. But it's been kept out of the mainstream. And it's very likely that that's what lies behind Fast Track. The OECD is aiming to have this agreement reached by May 1998. And if it goes through in secret, there won't be any protest about it. It'll be instituted, and it'll have become, in effect, a treaty. A treaty means it's very hard to get out of a treaty. That's the point of it. You sort of lock policy into treaty arrangements, then it becomes, you know, harder to, for small countries, it's hopeless. They're stuck with it. The rich countries like the United States can do what they like no matter what the treaties are, but it essentially locks them in. It's now conceded, incidentally, publicly conceded, that the purpose of NAFTA was not to modify trade or anything like that, but it was to lock Mexico into the reforms, make sure they would never get, you know, they'd never be able to extricate themselves from the so-called reforms, which have been a total disaster for the overwhelming majority of Mexicans, but have led to a very substantial increase in the number of billionaires and have been very good for American investors and so on. So the idea is to lock them in, and the idea behind this treaty is to lock everybody into these arrangements. Well, it's better to do that in secret, and the reasons are sometimes even given. The Wall Street Journal had an article on Fast Track in which, like the 100% of the rest of the press, it was deploring the fact that there's so much opposition to it, because they were all in favor of it. In fact, all wealthy sectors have been almost uniformly in favor of it, not surprisingly. And they said that the problem, the Wall Street Journal pointed out, that the problem is, they said, that Fast Track that the he said the opponents of fast track, like the labor movement, have an ultimate weapon. Now, what's the ultimate weapon? Well, the ultimate weapon is that the population is opposed to it. And that's tricky. In fact, that's the problem that Madison was facing when he designed the Constitution. If you let that ultimate weapon operate, then it might be used to infringe on private, unaccountable private power, and that's no good because it might lead to democracy. So we got to watch that. It might lead to democracy and social welfare and relative equality and all those things we try to avoid. Well, that's if you look at other aspects of what's going on, you find exactly the same thing. So I mentioned that the Reaganites were extreme in their violation of market principles, as indeed they were. But it still continues. Let's just take some couple of recent headlines, and I'll end with that. The few days ago, or about a week ago, I guess, in the business section of the New York Times, there was an upbeat article saying that for the first time, the United States had taken the lead in speed of supercomputers. So U.S. supercomputers were now faster than Japanese supercomputers for the first time. Notice I'm not talking about tomatoes. I'm talking about a centerpiece of the, you know, advanced high-tech economy. So now it turned out this year, Cray Research, which is a big supercomputer maker, had managed to produce a supercomputer that was faster than the Japanese. So we have first place. Great. Shows the miracles of the market. What they didn't point out was a couple of other things. A couple of days before that, there had been a headline in the Wall Street Journal on the new Clinton administration decision to extend a Reagan agreement to bar Japanese supercomputers from the U.S. market. The Reagan administration simply barred supercomputers from the U.S. market because they were too good and were better than U.S.-made ones. And the Reagan administration, the Clinton administration, just extended that with a new bar against Japanese supercomputers in the U.S. market. And the Wall Street Journal said straight out, this is in order to protect Cray Research primarily, which can't compete with the Japanese. There are lots of other barriers. The virtually sole purchaser of supercomputers has been government institutions like the Pentagon and the DOE and so on. And for them, Japanese supercomputers are totally barred. Okay, so they're not even allowed to compete for that. That's America first, you know. So for the market for supercomputers, the Japanese are barred altogether. Now they're barred. The Reagan administration furthermore barred them from import. Now the Clinton administration has extended it. Now, finally, Cray has better supercomputers. Why? Because of the technical advances in massively parallel computing, which, it turns out, were supported and developed by the government, by DARPA, the Defense Research Project Agency, funded by the government. Government means the public. So designed, funded by the public, right through the 1980s with large-scale new expenditures. So while the Reaganites were closing off the market to Japanese supercomputers, the state system here, which usually works under a Pentagon cover, that's the main source of advanced technology and so on, the Pentagon system was creating, meaning your taxes, were designing and creating new computer technology, massively parallel computing, which Cray Research was then able to use to finally build the fastest computer after having shut down the Japanese, cut out the Japanese, continuing, because we don't want to take any chances, to continue to block them from the market. Well, this turns out to be quite typical. This is not a, if you want to, well, that would, I'll give you one last example. This is true of every dynamic sector of the economy, virtually every dynamic sector of the economy. Cray is maybe extreme. Cray is called private enterprise, which is partly true. The profits are private and the management is private, but nothing else about it is private. The market is government, almost totally government. The technology is state subsidized, developed, and supported. But the profits are, and if there's any risk, that's taken by the public. So risk is socialized, cost is socialized, ideas are socialized, development is socialized, But profit is, and they're protected from competition, but profit is privatized and management remains privatized. That's very typical of the way the economy works. I said that was going to be the last example, but I'll give you one more. The World Bank Development Report, which is quite interesting, those things are worth reading. They are now in favor of what they call state market interaction. They think it's a good thing, it's a shift from before. And they give their prime example of healthy state market interaction, the way it ought to work, state-private interaction, working at its best. The example is the Internet. That's their example. Well, let's take a look at the Internet. The Internet was developed for about 30 years, completely by the public. All of the software, the hardware, you know, the satellites, I mean, everything about it was completely within the public domain, the packeting systems, all the new designs. In fact, the only part that wasn't created by the public in the United States was created by the public in Europe. The basic ideas for the World Wide Web came out of CERN, you know, the international laboratory in Geneva, which is again an international government laboratory. That's virtually the whole story. After about 30 years of this, just right now, the last two or three years, it's handed over to private power. So Bill Gates, who was typical parasite, you know, kind of watching on the outside, absolutely no interest, now wants to take over the Internet. And is heading to do it, and private power is not being secret about what they intend to do. What they want to do is take this system developed at public expense, initiative, ideas, technology, and so on, and use it for two purposes. One purpose is for what's called an intranet, that is to carve out big pieces of it, which are simply used for purposes of corporate transactions. So if General Electric wants to have, you know, interactions between its office and, you know, New York and Zurich or wherever they are, you know, Penang and so on, they'll have this closed system with firewalls so you can't break into it, and that'll just be for them, and similarly for other big corporations, other major private tyrannies. So that'll be a large part of the public system, and the rest of it is supposed to be used as kind of like a home marketing service to try to turn people into passive consumers, you know, you and the tube, that's the social unit on which society is constructed. So you don't have to worry about interacting, thinking people doing really bad things like those folks in the slums of Port-au-Prince a couple of years ago. But people will be passive and obedient and hooked on consuming for themselves, not caring about anyone else. And then you really won't have to worry much about the threat of democracy, at least that's the idea. Meanwhile, massive propaganda in the ideological institutions teaches you all sorts of mantras and so on and so forth. Now, that's pretty much the way the story works, I think, at any point where you look at it in detail. So anyhow, my suggestion is take the slogans and look at them, you know, take them apart, see what they actually mean when you look at them in practice. Where do they work? Where don't they work? How do they work? What are the results? I think you find a picture that's very, very different from the conventional one.